Once you've decided what it is you're going to look for in terms of the signal domain, and you then start optimizing your equipment to do that job, you have another problem and you have to ask yourself, how are you actually going to search the sky? Because there are two things you can do. You can pick out nearby stars that are like the sun, where a planetary system exists and life arose on one of those planets, and which therefore have a higher a priori probability of being good targets to look at. Or you can decide to search the entire sky. Now, if you're going to do a targeted search, you use very large telescopes. You spend as much time as you possibly can pointing at that star and tracking it to develop a very good sensitivity to weak signals. And you do all the signal processing that we've been talking about. If, on the other hand, you've taken the sky survey approach, you can't use a big telescope. The beam's too small. It takes you forever to cover the whole sky. So you use a much smaller telescope, and you sweep it very rapidly across the sky so that you can see all directions. And that limits the amount of signal processing you can actually do and the complexity of the signals that you can look for. However, suppose that extraterrestrial technological signals are like the stars on the sky. You go out there tonight, you look up. Some stars are brighter than others. The bright stars are not the nearby ones. They're actually stars that are much farther away than the faint stars you see around you. But they're intrinsically so bright that they still appear bright, apparently, on our sky when we look at them. So it could be that we're absolutely right that the place to look is around a nice solar-type star. And there you'll find a technology sitting on a planet. But that solar-type star is so far away that it doesn't appear in our catalogs. We have a very limited ability to actually find our targets as we go out in the Milky Way galaxy because dust begins to obscure them. So there's a perfectly good star sitting out there, but you don't know it, and you wouldn't otherwise look in that direction. However, it could be that there's a super civilization with a very strong transmitter, and so if you only happen to look in that direction briefly, you might still pick up the signal. So that's the premise of the All Sky Survey, and the NASA project, which was called the High Resolution Microwave Survey, in 1992, began on October 12th of 1992, which was the 500th anniversary of Columbus's discovery voyage of the New World. We began searching in both modes, at Puerto Rico and at Goldstone, at the NASA Deep Space Tracking Station. Well, when the Congress terminated NASA's funding for this project a year later, it became very obvious to us that we could not maintain the sky survey because it required the telescopes of NASA's Deep Space Network, and we no longer had access to those. And so the Phoenix project was a continuation of the targeted search only. And there are a couple of smaller sky surveys that are being continued today. One is sponsored by the Planetary Society, and the other is a project out of University of California at Berkeley, which is a piggyback project on the Arecibo telescope. So those sky surveys are ongoing, but there was no capability to do a targeted search except what we could bring to bear. So what we did was we got NASA to make us a long-term loan of the equipment, and then we began to put together a targeted search that could continue from the ashes of the NASA program. We have a candidate list of 1,000 nearby solar-type stars, which have been observed by colleagues at the Smithsonian, Harvard Smithsonian, and the Hubble Space Telescope Institute to check for two things. To check that their age is at least 3 billion years old, so that if evolution somewhere else takes as long as it did here to go from microbes to telescope builders, there will have been time. And to check to see that there are no awkwardly placed stellar companions. That is, that if it's a binary or a multiple system, the stars are separated widely enough so that it's possible to have stable planetary orbits nestled in close to one of the stars. So our 1,000 target list has been screened for those two characteristics, as well as the stars themselves being like the Sun in terms of its mass and luminosity and stability. This is the Milky Way galaxy, or a cartoon of it. The distance across that galaxy is 100,000 light years. The nearest 1,000 Sun-like stars occupy a distance from the Earth that's only 155 light years in diameter. And to draw that distance on this larger picture, it's actually smaller than the little laser dot right there. And that takes us out 100 light years in radius and gives us 1,000 targets. But you can see that that's really just stepping out our front door. If we wanted to look at 1,000,000 targets, which may be our next program, we'd have to go out 1,000 light years, and we yet can't categorize the solar type stars out to 1,000 light years, but that's coming. If we wanted to search the entire Milky Way galaxy for an analog of the Earth's current technology, we know that we'd have to do about 1,000,000 times more than we're currently capable of doing, which is why I started this talk by saying that this may be a problem for the generations. We may not be successful tomorrow or next week at PARCS. We certainly hope we will be, but we take the long view that this may be something that's a while in coming. One of the things that we learned when we worked at Arecibo on our targeted search was that one telescope is not enough. We have equipment that is optimally sensitized for detecting narrowband signals, and it detects them all the time. It detects our own technology. It detects our garage door openers, our airport radars, our cellular telephones, our satellite television communication, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And our biggest problem becomes one of trying to verify that the detected candidate signal is in fact coming from the stars and not just leaking in the side lobes of our antenna from some local source. So with a single telescope, you really have no alternative except when you get a candidate signal to interrupt your observations and move that telescope off source, in which case the signal should go away. Move it back on source, in which case you should get the signal back again, if it's really coming from the star. At Arecibo, we did that. We only had the single telescope, large as it was. And we found that, in fact, it's not good enough because the interference is not constant, but varies in time in a way that can absolutely fool that on-off-on procedure. So here in PARCS and into the future, we will use two telescopes as a minimum. They will be widely separated so they don't experience the same local interference environment. And we will make an interferometric measurement to confirm that a candidate signal seen at this telescope is also seen at this telescope. And it has the signature emplaced on it that the motion of the Earth through space provides if the signal is in fact coming from a distant star. The two telescopes, because telescopes, and at least from my wise point of view, are quite beautiful pieces of technology. Here's the 64-meter telescope at PARCS, and here's the smaller 22-meter telescope at Coonabarabran. And what happens is that we have a whole lot of processing gear here at the main telescope to search the frequency domain, the microwave spectrum, from 1 to 3 gigahertz. It's a lot of gear, and it finds candidates. Now, once we know where to look, it doesn't take so much gear. We have smaller, what we call follow-up detection devices that we've developed over the past 2 years. And they sit here at PARCS and also out here at MOPRA. And because our search methodology is to pick up a star and track it for hours across the sky, tuning the frequency at which we search as we march along. Then our follow-up device, because we're still tracking the star with both of these telescopes, can simply go back in frequency to where the candidate was found and reobserve in a cooperative effort with this telescope at MOPR as an interferometer. And it's proved extraordinarily effective at discriminating against terrestrial and orbiting interference. The whole SETI project is, as currently seen in the science community, is assuming that telescopes exist, large enough telescopes around the world exist. And we put all our effort into what we bring to the telescope. And it's pretty considerable in terms of the technological developments that have taken place. It may be that in the future we have to look at how we build large telescopes that can be dedicated to this project. And it turns out that we are now paralleling in that interest, the interest of the radio astronomy community, which are beginning to talk about projects to build 1 kilometer square radio telescopes. Just dandy for SETI. And we would like perhaps to replicate those. And in fact, I point out that back in 1972, when Barney Oliver conducted an engineering study between Stanford University and NASA Ames Research Center called Project Cyclops, which was really the first look at how you might use our technology to do this job, they proposed to build 1,600 100-meter telescopes, which is a 0.89 KT, a square kilometer telescope. So for a long time, we've already been thinking about that, and it may be coming in the future.